May of 2001, the New York Times Magazine ran a cover story. Here was the title: Naked Capitalists, There's No Business Like Porn Business. Now, the thesis was pretty simple, as you could imagine, that the adult entertainment industry is big business, with profits of $10 billion to $14 billion in annual sales. A short time later, Forbes magazine challenged that annual sales figure, saying that it should be revised downward to something like $3 to $4 billion. Whatever the figure is, $4 billion or $14 billion, that's still a lot of money. And let's not be naive either. I read an article earlier this year. A full article appeared in the New York Times detailing the number of young women who are addicted to pornography as well as men. The point is that sex has always been a big seller. It's even this way for the typical primetime TV show, right? You know, this kind of boring, typical plot. At some point in an episode, the person who's married comes off as looking miserable, while the person who's free to play the field looks happy and content. That's the way our culture views physical intimacy. It's best enjoyed with explicit materials and outside of marriage. Sadly, many people believe that. I think what's sadder still is that some Christians believe that too. And I wonder if you're one of them this morning. You see, the world thinks that Christians, being opposed to anything that brings pleasure, are therefore opposed most to sex, since it brings the most pleasure in life. So the British historian Thomas Macaulay quipped, "The Puritan hated bear baiting, not because it gave pain to the bear, but because it gave pleasure to those who watched." Or consider the evaluation of the satirist H.L. Mencken, who described Puritanism, a form of Christianity, as the haunting fear that someone somewhere might be happy. Well, what do you think of that this morning? Do you think that the best physical intimacy is outside of marriage? Do you think that many Christians downplay love and sex, even in marriage, because it's frankly a guilty pleasure? Well, let's be clear, crystal clear at the beginning. This is no hyperbole at all. No one should enjoy sex and marriage more than a Christian. The best, most sensual place to enjoy intimacy is in marriage. That's certainly at least a part of the message coming out of Ecclesiastes that we saw a few weeks ago, in which every aspect of life, by every, the writer of Ecclesiastes means every, by every aspect of life is to be enjoyed in the fear of God as a gift from God. It's also a message of the entire book of the Bible called the Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs. Would you turn there this morning, please, if you have a copy of the Bible? If you open the Bible, it's almost right in the middle. It's around that book called Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. So you can turn right in the middle, and it might help if the Bible you have might say Song of Songs. Now, if you weren't aware of this before today, you will be by the time the time ends today, that the Song of Solomon addresses the topic of human sexuality. Now, think of that, friends. Think of that. The Bible dedicates an entire book to the issue of human sexuality. Now, we have to be very careful, and please note this well. Song of Solomon doesn't say everything there is to say about this topic. It's not everything the Bible has to say about the topic. But it does say some very important things about the topic. Now, we're all aware that this kind of issue should be handled with modesty. Certainly it should. The Scripture does handle it with modesty. But that doesn't mean the topic should never be addressed, or that we should be embarrassed to talk about it. In fact, I think that in many ways the church should be leading the way in talking about human sexuality. We have a very positive view of the physical body, the physical life, and a positive view of sex. After all, we claim that God has given us His Word on this matter. 8 chapters, at the very least, on this matter. He is redeeming everything. And if the curse in Genesis 1 affected everything, the Song of Solomon is showing at least what physical intimacy can look like under the sun. He's making everything new. He's even redeeming the cheap and tawdry, banal things that's often viewed like that in physical intimacy. I think that our failure to think about these issues, particularly in our families and churches, does far more harm than good. We've taken something that God intends as a gift of pleasure and wonder and turned it into something we scold our children for asking about or berate our spouses for asking more of. For many of us, we really think it should remain a dirty little secret. What a horrible way to view one of God's most precious gifts of all creation. To despise this gift, to undervalue this gift, is to undervalue and despise the giver of the gift himself. Well, in February of 2010, some of you are familiar with the writings of Albert Mohler, who is the president of a Southern Baptist seminary in Kentucky, and he warns preachers of being too silent about the topic. He writes, "Evangelicals should consider our own responsibility in teaching about human sexuality. Far too many evangelical pastors teach virtually nothing about a biblical understanding of human sexuality. This leaves much of the Bible unpreached and a congregation woefully untaught. It's not enough to believe the right things about what the Bible teaches concerning sex and sexuality. It is necessary to affirm the Bible's truthfulness and authority in every dimension it addresses, but even this is not enough. Congregations are filled with people who need a word from the Lord on this matter that's so central to human identity and so ubiquitous in our culture. What I'm telling you is that in the kind providence of our great Christ, He's given us a word on this matter, and that's what we're going to look at this morning. How kind of God to explain this most precious gift. How kind." Let me say one more thing. Well, at least the introduction, I'll say a lot more things. I realize that there are some here who probably hear this message this morning who might be affected from some kind of sexual abuse, divorce, or even confusion about your own sexual orientation. The intent this morning in Song of Solomon isn't the intent to make anybody feel awkward or make you clam up or to inflict more pain. What we're simply trying to do is to address sex as God intended it to be, not as you might have experienced it. So we all need to listen this morning. All of us need to listen this morning and to form and reform our thinking on this matter. Reject, friends, reject what is fraudulent and abusive and counterfeit. Reject it outright. And accept what He has made to be good, even very good. This is the God who celebrates sex and marriage. Now, we're going to start this morning by reading a number of selections from the book. And before we do, if you read the book in preparation for this week, you'll know that you'll be struck by some rather odd-sounding comparisons. Your hair is like a flock of goats. That hardly compares anything romantic to us today. You might end up with a slap in the face or the like if you tried that kind of comparison. But just know, you're aware of this, but just know that though these comparisons, many of them are lost on us to the original reader, surely they communicated something very tender and very sensual, and that's how they were received. So just look over that and think, oh, that must be something really nice. That doesn't sound very nice at all. So let's listen. Listen, I want you to hear these two lovers celebrating their love for each other. Look with me in chapter 4, verse 1, if you'd like to follow along. I'm reading from the English Standard Version. Chapter 4, verse 1, here is the man writing a love poem to his lover. "Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one of them has lost its young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David built in rows of stone, and on it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that graze among the lilies. Until the day breathes and the shadows flee, I will go away to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense." And then he summarizes in verse 7, "You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. Now she's got some adoring of herself to do. She won't be outdone. So in chapter 5, you can turn there if you'd like. Chapter 5, starting in verse 10, here is one of her love poems. My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting beside a full pool. His cheeks are like beds of spices, mounds of sweet-smelling herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. His arms are rod of gold, set with jewels. His body is polished ivory, bedecked with sapphires. His legs are like alabaster columns, set on bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet, and he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Finally, he writes back with another poem in chapter 7. Chapter 7 is another one of these love poems. He starts by adoring her feet. How beautiful, chapter 7, verse 1, are your feet in sandals, O noble daughter. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is an ivory tower. Your eyes are pools in Heshbon by the gates of Bath Rabim. Your nose is like a tower of Lebanon which looks towards Damascus. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in the tresses. How beautiful and pleasant you are, O loved one, with all your delights. Your statue is like a palm tree, and your breast like its clusters. I say I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its fruit. Oh, may your breast be like clusters of the vine, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your mouth be like the best wine. Now, we're not left to think how she responds to this kind of poem. She says, it goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over his lips. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Well, you can tell this romantic couple expresses their desires for each other in some pretty frank and sensual ways. And because this is love poetry, we're also aware that there's surely a lot of double meaning. There's lots of euphemisms going on here. And I assure you that if you think the surface of this poetry sounds explicit, that what lies beneath some of these expressions is just not explicit. It's just very erotic what he and she are actually saying. And the wonderful thing is, friends, that God himself is celebrating this kind of love. It's a gift from God. Now, if you're noticing the frank talk and you're feeling a bit uncomfortable by all these romantic expressions we've just read, just know you're not alone. You're not alone. The way people have tried to interpret this book in the history of the church shows that there have been lots of people who've been uncomfortable with the unbridled romantic expressions in the book. What do I do with this? So, as a way to responding to the frankness, Christian people have responded in two main ways. And you're probably aware of the first. The first one is to come to the book and say, this is all allegorical. There's nothing physical at all. This is all pointing us to things that are spiritual. And the chances are, if you've heard anybody preach on the Song of Solomon, it's been explained as pure allegory. The problem is that those who know allegory, the genre, come to this and say, this isn't the genre of allegory. The lips mean lips. The hair means hair. And so on. So just let me be clear, the allegorical interpretation, purely so, is just wrong. So what does this mean? I think it simply is, this is a collection of real love poems celebrating the real pleasures of love. That's what's going on. These are real love poems, not signifying something greater meaning like some allegory, but these are real love poems celebrating the real pleasures of love. That's the nature of the book. What about the structure of the book? Not only have interpreters said, is this allegory or is this real love poetry? They've also said, does this book have any structure to it? There are some who see the book as advancing a plot. They see it as a drama. On the one hand, it either moves from courtship to engagement to consummation to life after marriage. That's one way the book is viewed. Or there's another dramatic view that says, no, this is a peasant girl and a peasant man who are in love, and here comes great King Solomon trying to woo and break up the happy couple. And in the end, she kind of tells Solomon off and says, get lost, I love this guy, and true love wins out over power and prestige. Now, although a number of people adopt that kind of view, and maybe it's your own, I'm just not convinced. Partly because what those dramatic views do is they'll often say that the marriage is consummated either in chapter 4 at the earliest or chapter 8 at the latest, and then you have to come up with some really imaginative interpretations about the explicit sexual euphemisms that happen in chapters 1 and 2. And I have to say, that's not really happening. It just seems simplest to me, and my way of looking at the book, that this isn't allegory, it's literal, and there isn't a real structured, well-structured story being advanced. Rather, it's a real collection of poems that are indeed held together by certain themes that are celebrating the glories of love in marriage. Now, if I've lost you a bit over the last few minutes over the discussion of the nature and the book, don't worry. Okay, you're not alone. One writer notes, no book of the Bible, except perhaps Revelation, suffers so many radically different interpretations as the Song of Songs. So don't be upset with me if you don't agree with my take. The things that I will say, everybody says, I think, regardless of your interpretation. So this is a well-organized collection of love poems exchanged between a man and a woman. Now, three more things to mention that will be helpful as you read this book in the future, and as you hear this morning. The first has to do, of course, with figures of speech. All poetry, especially love poetry, is going to employ figures of speech. And so we have various terms of endearment that surface in this book. And the first chapter, you can turn there, or you can just listen. In the first chapter, she refers to her man as a king. Chapter 1, verse 4. Draw me after you. Let us run away. The king has brought me into his chambers. But in verse 7, she addresses her man and compares him to a shepherd. Tell me, you whom my soul loves, where you pasture your flock, where you make it lie down at noon. For why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? Now, I think we understand these terms of endearment quite well. We might refer to our own spouse by pet names, and we won't embarrass ourselves by sharing any of those this morning. But simply because we have several pet names or terms of endearment doesn't mean we're referring to different people. We often have various terms of endearment, various figures of speech for the way that we refer to our spouse. And we not only have these terms of endearment, but we also have objects in the poem that stand in for other things. And people who know ancient Near Eastern love poetry well says that the Song of Solomon fits in quite well with the genre of ancient Near Eastern love poetry. The beneficial thing of stating that fact is that we know that in those poems, certain objects can stand in or represent something. So when the lady or the couple refers to herself, or he refers to her as a vineyard or a garden, they're actually referring to the lady herself, her own body, sometimes to very specific parts. So in your chill in chapter 1, you look down at verse 5, the lady bemoans the fact that as a result of hard labor forced upon her by her brothers, she has skin that's dark, or darkened and burned by the sun. As a result of her hard work, she's not as attractive as the other ladies who might have dainty or light skin. So look how she describes herself in the middle of verse 6. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept. Now hopefully you see her point. Because I've been working in the vineyards for my brothers, I've not been able to keep up my own vineyard. That I've not been able to keep up my appearances. I've not been able to keep up my body to keep it attractive. So the figure of a vineyard or a garden appears again and again throughout the book, and it refers to the lady herself. Second, understand the characters of the book. We've already met the romantic couple, of course. And we need to meet the others in this book And if you have a modern translation, you might even say, I'm reading from the ESV, and when you get to the middle of verse 4, it actually has a heading in all caps that says, Others. Well, the others in this book function like the chorus in a Greek play. In the ESV, some of the verses have she above them. Some of the verses have he above them. And then, like I just mentioned, you'll notice if you have a modern translation, it says he or she, and then maybe it says others or young women or young maidens or something. Now, what you can see at the end of verse 4 is that those young maidens, those others described, are probably young maidens or virgins at the end of verse 3. Or at the beginning of verse 5, they're referred to as, O daughters of Jerusalem. The point again is that, like a chorus in a Greek play, this group of others, these young ladies, serve to interpret and advance the action of each poem that's given to us. And it's in these verses, what's interesting to me, it's the verses that are preceded by the heading young women or others that actually gives us the warrant for using this book in a mixed company of those who are married and those who are not married. The chorus, the others, is made up of young maidens, young virgins, people who are not married. So while this chorus, this group of single people, they witness all this sensual interaction. And while we must exercise caution in discussing sexuality so frankly, the structure of this book assumes the presence and participation even of those who aren't married. That's the chorus, the others, the young women. And by the time the book ends, this group of single people is exposed both to the agony of love as well as the ecstasies of love. Two times the sensual couple turns to their single friends and warns them strongly, don't awaken love before it's time. Twice, very, very strongly. So this book gives us wonderful advice for instructing not only the married, but also the unmarried. And just in passing, I would encourage, as our children get older, and for those of you whose children are, moms and dads, don't turn first to Dr. Dobson to teach your children about God's gift of sex. Turn to Song of Solomon. That's why it's in the Bible. One of the reasons, anyway. Now, the last thing I think it's important for us to note before we dig into the contents of this is to think about the kind of love being celebrated here. There's no question love is being celebrated, but what kind of love is being celebrated? Song of Solomon celebrates the sensual love between one man and one woman in marriage. The Song of Solomon celebrates the sensual, erotic love between one man and one woman in marriage. The book tells us, friends, don't underestimate this. The book tells us the most sensual, the hottest, the most enjoyable place to enjoy physical intimacy is within the marriage of one man and one woman. Everything else is a cheap, tawdry imitation that can be reduced to $20 in a motel room. Don't settle for the cheap, tawdry imitation. He's lifting up the ideal for us. This is where it's at. Don't be fooled. Don't be fooled. God knows where this gift of His is to be enjoyed, and it's best in marriage. I'm not making this up. We could give many reasons why the book celebrates the sexual love of one man and one woman in marriage, but just think of the title of the song, Some of your translations have the Song of Songs. That comes right from chapter 1, verse 1. This is the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Now you know, you'll probably recognize that's a superlative. Holy of Holies means the most holy place. King of Kings means there's no greater king. In the same way, the Song of Songs means this is the greatest song ever. This is the ideal song. This is the Song of Songs. There's no better song than this. And what is this ideal song celebrating? Love. What kind of love? Love exchanged between one man and one woman. Do you see that? And when you take into account that this book is categorized as wisdom literature, the connection is unmistakable. Because one of the purposes of wisdom literature is to hold up to us the ideal. Wisdom literature says this is what's best and wise. This is the greatest kind of love. Intimacy finds its ideal expression, its fullest expression, in the love between one man and one woman. So, beloved, here's an entire book of the Bible that condemns heterosexual aberrations, homosexuality, polygamy, prostitution, pedophilia, bestiality, whatever it is, it's condemned. And the way it's condemned is not outright, but by holding up what's ideal. This is the best. Everything else is a cheap, worthless imitation. This, Song of Solomon is saying, is God's ideal. Everything else is phony and hollow. Now, if we struggle in any of those other areas, aberrations that we mentioned, it's okay, and I wouldn't want anybody to be embarrassed or to suppress the struggle. That's not the point. The point is to encourage us with the Bible's overwhelmingly positive message concerning the enjoyment of physical intimacy in marriage. That's the ideal. Now, someone could grant that the love being extolled here is between a man and a woman, but how do we know that they're married? That might feel like special pleading a little bit. Well, turn to the end of chapter 3 and verse 11. Now, these are, again, if I'm saying an individual collection of love poems, you might say this doesn't apply to the all, but they're taken this way and viewed this way. Chapter 3, verse 11, "Go out, O daughters of Zion, and look upon King Solomon with a crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart." The day of his wedding. Or we look at chapters 4 and 5. Now, chapters 4 and 5, regardless of somebody's view of how the book is organized, everybody agrees that chapters 4 and 5 serve as the center of the book in some way. What's at the center of the book is being held up as very, very important. And in chapter 4, the man is pleading with his female lover. Look with me at verses 8 to 12 of chapter 4. Notice how the beginning of each section starts. Chapter 4, verse 8. "Come with me from Lebanon, my bride." Verse 9. "You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. How beautiful is your love." Verse 10. "My sister, my bride." Verse 11. "Your lips drip nectar, my bride." Verse 12. "A garden locked is my sister, my bride." Now, maybe you got tripped up by sister. We know from ancient Near East literature that sister was a very romantic term of endearment, not meaning anything that we mean today. It was another term of endearment, a pet name. But you see, again and again and again, this refers to my bride or the day of the wedding. So Song of Solomon celebrates the sensual and erotic love of one man and one woman in marriage. Now, if you knew that we were talking about Song of Solomon, you're probably finally ready for the part that you wanted to come for. So let's now look at what this book says. Turn to chapter 8, please. Turn to chapter 8. Chapter 8. This chapter contains the key verses of the entire book. They contain the theme of the entire book. And regardless of somebody's theory, whether they see this book as advancing a plot or drama, or somebody sees this as a collection of poetry, both groups agree chapter 8 contains the thematic verses, the key verses, for understanding the entire book. The lady or the wife is speaking, and notice what she says starting in verse 6. She says to her man, "Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy as fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised." Those are the theme verses of the book. That's what you have to wrestle with to put everything else in context. So notice the woman's commands. "Set me as a seal on your heart. Set me as a seal on your arm." What she's essentially saying is, take me and own me as your own. Or more than that, setting a seal in the ancient world, you took your ring or something that made an impression and you stuck it in a piece of pottery that's drying or in a piece of hot wax that's drying. And when you were done, your seal recognized, I own that. That's mine. It belongs to me. It's my precious possession. But the object to be sealed isn't pottery or wax. It's his heart. Let me be your owner, she says. Willingly give yourself to me like no one else. Set me as a seal on your heart. Do you hear how exclusive this love is? Set me as a seal. Let me own you. Nobody else. Then she says, let me be a seal on your arm as well. Now, this might be just poetic variation, but it could also be she's saying, set me as a seal over your heart, your soul, and set me as a seal over your body. Let me own the complete, your entire body, heart, and soul. Let it be mine. Give your body to me and to no one else. Let your soul, your affections, your body belong exclusively to me. I want exclusive rights to all of you. That's what she's saying and passionately pleading with her lover. I don't even think it's stretching the metaphor to say that she's asking that we be one in some poetic sense, that a seal might become of the part of the object that it's sealing. And then she gives the reason for her command. Let me own you entirely, she says. And now her reasons. She's going to say, in effect, look, baby, it has to be this way. It's the irresistible nature of love to be passionate and exclusive and committed. First, she says this. It has to be this way because love is as strong as death. It's a powerful statement. Death is the one thing that nobody can resist. It's irrevocable. You can't avoid it. It's powerful. No amount of power or wealth can resist it. And in this beautiful mixture of images and feelings, she says the only thing as powerful and irresistible as death is love. Love is as irresistible and powerful as death. Second, she says we have to be passionate and exclusive in our relationship because jealousy is as fierce as the grave. We recognize there are forms of jealousy that are wrong, but we also recognize there are forms of jealousy that are not only right, but they're praiseworthy. One writer explains it like this. There are two relationships described in the Bible where jealousy is a potentially appropriate action. The divine human relationship and the marriage relationship. Humans can have only one God. If they worship another, that triggers God's jealousy. And God's jealousy is an energy that tries to rescue the relationship. That's what happens in Hosea. That's God's jealous love. Similarly, a man and a woman can have only one spouse. If there's a threat to the relationship, then jealousy is a proper emotion. And all this is because so much hangs on the integrity of the relationship. It's so basic, so deep, that it stirs up strong emotions and passions. And her jealousy is as fierce and tenacious as the grave. Just like the grave overcomes all obstacles, so true love is jealous and overcomes all resistance. So set me as a seal on your heart. Because it's the nature of love to be powerful and irresistible as death. It's its nature to be fiercely loyal and to take sole possession like the grave does. Love is passionate and exclusive. It's pursuing and powerful like death and jealousy. Then skip the end of verse 6 and look with me in verse 7. She continues to explain how the nature of true love demands that he set her as a seal when he says, many waters cannot quench love, nor floods drown it. Just think of the raging, surging power of floodwaters, the force and power of a tsunami. She's saying that true love can do what buildings and buses and cement fixtures and mighty oaks cannot do, stand tall and resist the fiercest forces of nature. Many waters can't quench them. Or maybe the imagery is better thought of a flame flickering in the wind. And what is more deadly to a flame than water? and yet many floodwaters, though they threaten to engulf it, the flame burns on. Many waters cannot quench it. Floodwaters cannot drown it. Love can endure anything. It endures the fiercest storm and lives. And then she says, the end of verse 7, true love is absolutely priceless. Because if a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. A man or woman who marries for money isn't being shrewd or wise. Don't believe that. They're to be despised. And if you trade true love for all the wealth of Solomon, you're a fool and to be despised. In fact, she raises the imagery of Solomon to make that point a few verses later. Solomon is a symbol of immense wealth and unfortunately countless women. And she raises him, I think, as a poetic foil. She raises him up. We're told in 1 Kings that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, a symbol indeed of having all the wealth and women that somebody could want. But now look in verse 11 and remember that a vineyard is often used to refer to the female body. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He left out the vineyard to the keepers, and each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. But notice how she responds to his wealth and honor of being a part of his harem, or his very valuable vineyard. But my vineyard, Solomon, my vineyard, that is, my body, is my very own. O Solomon, keep your 1,000 pieces of silver. I'll give my body to whomever I want, and I'm giving it exclusively to him. Your money can't touch my body, but he can. I spit on your money, and I take true love. At one level, that is the theme of the song, that it's supportive of exclusive, devoted sexual love that overcomes all obstacles and threats to its purity and joy. All other threats are wiped out as true love burns brightly, remains passionately committed, and is set like a seal on the heart. So what Song of Solomon is teaching, and pardon the alliteration here, not purely, but Song of Solomon is teaching that love that comes from God is passionate, and it's pursuing, and it's persevering, and it's priceless, and it's exclusive. Now what I want to know is, where does that kind of love come from? Where do we find a love that's passionate and pursuing and persevering and exclusive? If you look at the end of verse 6, still in chapter 8, the end of verse 6, here is love's source. Its flashes are the flashes of fire, the very flame of Yah, or Yahweh, the very flame of the Lord. Now I realize that not every translation has a very flame of the Lord, but it should have a footnote telling you that's a very possible translation. And I think the ESV and the New American Standard have it right. Love, like an intense flame, finds its source in God. The kind of erotic marital love described in this book is a flame from the Lord. So Walter Kaiser has said, this entire book is a marriage manual to help us understand that marriage, for those who fear God, is a gift from Jehovah. It's to be used with fidelity to the pledged partner, with great physical, aesthetic, emotional, and spiritual joy. Song of Solomon describes sexual love as God intends it to be for all who fear Him. And on keeping then with the emphasis of wisdom literature, and keeping with the emphasis of fearing God that comes out again and again, the fear of God manifests itself in a marriage with love that's passionate and pursuing and exclusive and persistent. That's what living in light of God's fear means to someone who's married. Now, here at the end, I want to take several minutes and just show you this theme that God designs a couple to enjoy one another with a love that's passionate and pursuing and exclusive and persistent, and to show you how that shows up throughout this collection of poems. First, the fear of God manifests itself in a love that's passionate. Now, you know this, but Song of Solomon endorses sex and celebrates it beyond all expectation. It's saying, you will find physical intimacy and marriage delightful here like no place else. I want to encourage those of you who are married to get with your spouse, grab a good study Bible or a good commentary, and explore the countless sexual euphemisms in the book. And with very little comment, I want to read a poem that we referred to earlier. It's back in chapter 4. And what we're about to read is a man expressing his desire for the body of his lover, his wife. And she reciprocates, the relationship is consummated, and then the chorus pronounces their approval of what has just happened. Listen to the God who celebrates sex and marriage. Chapter 4, verse 8. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak of Sanir and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A spring locked, a fountain sealed. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with all choicest fruits, henna with nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all choice spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of living water, flowing streams from Lebanon. Then I think she speaks in verse 16, Awake, O north wind! Come, O south wind! Blow upon my garden! Let its spices flow and entice him to come. And then she says, Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. In between end of 4 and beginning of 5, the relationship is consummated in a bed of fragrant erotic passion, and then he reflects in verse 1 of chapter 5. I have come to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with spice. I ate my honeycomb and my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. He said, I've just not had her wine, but also her milk, not only her honey, but her honeycomb. He's enjoyed her completely, and from her response, she has loved it as well. Now we might say, is that kind of thing really okay? Listen to the chorus. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. People who fear God are drunk with the love of their spouse, and it's God's will. In chapter 6, the husband and the wife are even pictured as pleasuring one another with delights new and old. Chapter 6, verse 6 and verse 13. Which means Song of Solomon tells us it's okay to explore new areas of delight in your marriage, especially when health or age might demand it. And this book says there's a time when you can enjoy the delights of physical intimacy without thought of procreation at all. This book is celebrating the joys, the God who celebrates sex and marriage. People who fear God have love that's passionate. And people who fear God also have a love that's pursuing. Let's think about that in two ways. The first, they pursue each other verbally. I mean, you can't read this book without being taken back at the imaginative ways the couple describes one another. Their romantic banter is held up as a model for us. Do this, husband. Do this, wife. Pursue this type of verbal. Go after your wife. Go after your husband verbally like this. Start with the basics. When is the last time you just looked at your spouse right in the eyes and said, I love you? Or maybe you just sent a text in the middle of the day for no reason and just said, I'm thinking about you and I love you. Doesn't Song of Solomon at the least say that would probably be a good idea to pursue your wife verbally or your husband verbally like that? They include words of expression and praise. Do you praise your spouse on a regular basis? Do you praise her body? Do you praise his body regularly? Pursue your spouse verbally. Go through the book. Note all the pet names they have for each other. And when you've mastered that, how about have an email waiting for your spouse or a voicemail when they get in telling them what you'll do with them the next time you see them. That's what's happening in the book. It's encouraging that type of romantic, erotic banter. Do that. God celebrates that. If you don't pursue that kind of thing, it's like driving a Corvette on a street full of stoplights. It was meant for way more than that. Pursue this. And I think particularly for husbands, we can pursue our wives verbally with words of praise. I appreciate so much what C.J. Mahaney said in his little book, Sex, Romance, and the Glory of God, where he encourages men to pursue their wives and to praise them verbally. And he has this little phrase that says, touch their heart before you touch their body. And he's not saying butter them up with sweet talk. You know that. Love her with your words. My mom put it to me like this before I got married. Son, the best sex begins in the kitchen. Love and help your wife around the house. Pursue your wife verbally. But also pursue your spouse verbally. But the book teaches us to pursue each other by taking the initiative physically. It's okay for either of you to take the initiative physically. That's what they're doing. And particularly, I just thumped for a minute on the guys. Let me thump for a minute on the wives here. One of the things that took me back in this book is how aggressive the woman is in the book. In fact, just about any person that you would read on the book comments that the woman speaks twice as much as the man. And she's not talking about the kind of shoes that she bought. She talks twice as much as the man. The volume of her words alone shows it's okay and the woman is encouraged to initiate the pursuit. But the speech itself shows she's actually pursuing the sexual relationship. The first time someone speaks in the book, you know who it is? It's the lady. And you know what she says? Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Let us run away. How's that for taking the initiative? Then she gives a command in chapter 2, verse 17. Turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on cleft mountains. In chapter 4, verse 16, she gives the command again. Let my beloved come to my garden of delights. Let him eat of my choicest fruits. Even the key verses at the end of the book, it's the lady pursuing the man. Set me as a seal on your heart. Wives, imitate this lady and take the initiative sometimes. It's okay. God celebrates that. Pursue your spouse verbally and initiate the physical pursuit as well. This is the God who celebrates a love that's passionate and pursuing. The fear of God also manifests itself in a love that's exclusive. Now, you've seen that from the key verses of the book already. The couple are committing themselves to a love that's exclusive. It admits no rivals, no third party, and it's fiercely jealous of any threats. Twice we have this beautiful refrain, I am my beloved's and he is mine, chapter 2 and chapter 6. And in both contexts, it sums up a sexual encounter. Nobody else enjoys my beloved like this. Loving your spouse means that you will never allow a third party 1 ounce of your affection. That means faithfulness to your spouse admits no porn, no chat room, no flirting, no bonding intellectually or emotionally, and certainly not physically. I am my beloved's, and he is mine. It even means that your spouse gets your time and your energy like nobody else. If you're busy saving the world and you have no energy and time for your spouse, your love is not exclusive. If you're overcommitted and your marriage is affected, repent. If you're giving your affections to porn or to bonding with somebody other than your spouse, repent before the God who made you, who gives you this gift, and before your spouse, and reaffirm the kind of love God celebrates. It's passionate, it's pursuing, and it's exclusive. Lastly, the fear of God manifests itself in a love that's persevering. Not everything in this book goes easy for the couple. With frank honesty, the poems record the ecstasies of marriage, and they record the agonies of marriage as well. Chapters 3 and 5 contain the agonies of love. Both chapters are set in the context of a dream. The lady has a dream. In chapter 3, she seeks for her loved one, but she can't find him. The dream in chapter 3 describes the agony of alienation, even in marriage. We're not sure, but the alienation is either emotional or it's physical. In some sense, the spouse has withdrawn, and that hurts. How does she respond to emotional or physical alienation? Listen to chapter 3, verse 1. I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I found him not. She's hurt, but she's undeterred. So in verse 2, I will rise and go about the city. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I will even ask the watchman of the city, have you seen him whom my soul loves? She refuses to give up. She perseveres through the agony of alienation and doesn't end until the hurt is reconciled in chapter 3, verse 5, when she says this, when I found him whom my soul loves, I held him and I would not let him go until we consummated the marriage again. The overall point is clear. Sometimes marriage is accompanied by emotional and physical alienation, but true love perseveres and overcomes all deterrents, even hurtful ones. Now, the interpretation in chapter 5 of that dream is roughly the same, but the interpretations are a bit more diverse. I think that chapter teaches that true love perseveres through the deep hurt that comes from being rejected in the bedroom. So, she is sleeping, she has this dream, and in chapter 5, verse 2, she dreams that her lover comes knocking at the door. His request in chapter 5, verse 2, is that she open the door to him, which is a euphemism for opening up herself to him. And verse 3, we find out she's not as ready as he is. I've put off my garment. How can I put it on again? I've bathed my feet. How can I soil them? She's saying something like, I'm all ready for bed. I'm tired. I'm ready to go to sleep. Don't ask me to open up to you now. He persists a little bit. She tells us that he starts to put his hand through the keyhole, and when that happens in verse 4, she starts to warm up to the idea, and her heart thrills within her, verse 4. In verse 5, she responds, and she starts to open herself up to her beloved, but tragedy strikes. He's gone. Remember, this is a dream. He's gone. He's been hurt and disappointed to have his request put off, so he's withdrawn. And now she's hurt and disappointed because he's gone. Now let me ask you, have you ever been hurt, sometimes deeply so, by having your advances in the bedroom rejected? Some of you have been repeatedly rejected, and the hurt is almost unbearable. Husband or wife, you do untold hurt to your spouse when you reject them. If you regularly turn your spouse away, you're slowly chipping away at your spouse's sense of self-worth, and soon there will be nothing left at all. But the dream doesn't end with the hurt of sexual rejection. It ends with her persevering until they're reconciled again in chapter 6 and verse 2 when she says, "My beloved has come back to my garden again. Once more I can say I am his and he is mine." Now I think the dream in chapter 5 makes the same point in a far more poetic way that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians 7. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Conclusion, don't deprive one another sexually. Don't ever do it. Now, regardless, okay, let me step back. Regardless of the exact interpretation of these two dreams, the overall point is well stated, very clear. Love comes up against some agonizing obstacles, and true love perseveres. You know why? Because many waters can't quench love. Can't do it. God's love, the fear of God, manifests itself in a love in marriage that's passionate and pursuing and exclusive and persevering, for love is as strong as death. It's as jealous as the grave. No flood can drown it, for this is the flame from God. Now we're at the end. Think with me about two things. Tying up some loose ends a little bit. Putting in some footnotes here and there. First, remember again, this book is holding out for us God's ideal for sex and marriage. That means, beloved, if you're here this morning and your marriage is awful, this book is intended to give you hope. Your marriage and the grace and kindness and through prayer can be like this. Pursue this. Go after this. It's a book intended to give hope. And don't think like this. Don't despair. Don't think that, well, because my marriage isn't like this, this is never true. You're thinking the wrong way. The point of God celebrating the ideal of sex and marriage, its erotic aspects, its relational aspects, is to encourage us to keep striving for this. As good as your marriage is, it can be better. As awful as your marriage is, it can be better. So keep striving for this kind of marriage, because this is the God who celebrates sex and marriage. Now, if you've been thinking the whole morning, well, what about those who aren't married? Well, this book issues very strong warnings. Love is powerful. It's as strong as death. Sex is beautiful, but it's powerful and dangerous when entered into outside of marriage. As erotic as this book is, I told you at the beginning that in the beginning of the book in chapter 2 and at the end of the book in chapter 8, this romantic couple wheels around on their friends and says, "Don't you give away your heart or your body at any level until the time of God's love is ripe for you." Twice. "I adjure you," chapter 2, verse 7, "I adjure you, daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases." End of the book, 8:4. "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases." So, beloved, if God in His providence has allowed you to be in a dating relationship, don't stir up desires you cannot fulfill. If you're doing that now, hear the caution of this couple and repent. It's too dangerous. "I adjure you, brothers and sisters, that you not stir up or awaken love until it's fulfilled. Stop tempting and teasing one another, and certainly stop exploring one another. Love is priceless, full of pleasure, but it's powerful. Treat it like dynamite with great caution and great care. And again, beloved, if you're struggling with this, the point isn't to make somebody embarrassed and kind of clam up. We recognize that. We want to help and love and want everything that you want in God's time and fullness for you. And if God should never provide a marriage for you, don't believe the lie. You could hear this and say, you know what, this sounds like if you don't have sex, you're not fully human. It's not what's happening in the book. You think the greatest human who ever lived was Jesus Christ. He never experienced marriage. Jesus' life tells us you can live a very fulfilling, meaningful life and never be married. Don't think that you're less of a human if you don't fool around or you're not married. It's not true. That's such a wicked lie. This book contains strong warnings to the unmarried, but even the married are cautioned as well. I gave you homework last week. I told you to read with your spouse or a friend Proverbs 2, 5, 6, and 7. And those passages, Proverbs warns us. It warns us about pursuing sexual satisfaction outside of marriage. The erotic delights are meant to be experienced nowhere else but marriage. 2 weeks ago, we looked at Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes warns us that if you seek your ultimate happiness in anything under the sun, you'll be utterly frustrated. You know what that means? If your marriage never rises to the level of the sexual excitement that you think is in this book, it's okay. It really is okay. Because you know, sex was never intended to satisfy you ultimately and give you the contentment that only God can give. Ecclesiastes tells you that sex will never satisfy you ultimately anyway, and you should be too wise to fall for that lie now. You've seen a man like Tiger Woods, a modern-day Solomon, when it comes to wealth and to women, enjoy all the wealth and exciting partners a man could possibly want, and he comes up empty. You're too smart to fall from the mirage of ultimate satisfaction in sex. Besides, you've heard wisdom calling out to you in the street, telling you that nothing under the sun can satisfy your eternal desires. So strive for this, but don't despair because you're complete in Him. Strive for it, but don't put your ultimate happiness here, for you're complete in Him. Now here's the thing. I step back from the book and I say, God intends for marriage to be characterized by love that's passionate and pursuing and exclusive and persistent. And I ask myself, does that remind you of somebody's love? That's passionate and pursuing and exclusive and persevering. A love that's passionate. The Lord your God is with you. He's mighty to save. He will take great delight in you. He will dance over you with singing, Zephaniah 3:17. A love that's pursuing, Hosea 2:14. Therefore, beloved, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness, and I will speak tenderly to her. Jeremiah 31:1. I have loved you, my people, with an everlasting love. With unfailing love, I have drawn you to myself. A love that's exclusive. You are my people, holy to the Lord. I have chosen you to be a people for my treasured possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Deuteronomy 7:6. A love that's persevering. Hosea 11:1 and 8. When Israel was a child, I loved him. But the more I called, the more they ran away. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over? How can I treat you like Admah or Zeboyim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender even at your rebellion. Romans 5:8. God demonstrated his love towards us, and that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. Song of Solomon isn't an allegory, but the point is the Bible itself picks up the issue of love in marriage as a description of God's love for us. The love, friend, the love you so desperately crave as a single person or as an unfulfilled married person is found only in Jesus Christ. Only the gospel makes sense of our own intense craving for love. Because in the gospel, there's the story of a wooing God whose love makes sense of our own. His love is stronger than death. His jealousy is fiercer than the grave. His love, indeed, is the very flame from God. Many waters cannot quench His love. Floods cannot drown it. And what would it profit you if you gained the whole world in exchange for the love of God? Therefore, I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is passionate and pursuing and exclusive and persevering. And this love of God is found in Christ Jesus, our Lord. If you are not a follower of Jesus Christ, this book calls you to forsake every other lover and rest in His love for you alone that forgives and overcomes your sin. Husbands, love and serve your wife even as God has loved you in Christ. This is the God who celebrates sex and marriage.